Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, August 7th, 2012, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. If Mercury retrograde has been challenging you, here's some great news. It goes direct at 1:40 a.m., just a few hours from now, and I know we're all really glad about that. Right, ladies? So, our distinguished guest this evening has a spellbinding story about his discovery concerning ancient Maya technology. He is James O'Conn, a professional engineer as well as an archaeo-engineer. James has pursued a lifelong passion for Maya archaeology, and he has combined his unique professional engineering experience with the search for lost Maya technology. He's applied his engineering talents to explore and investigate Maya sites located deep in the dense rainforest. Traveling by dugout canoe, hacking his way through the tangled jungle while fighting off millions of insects and sleeping in tents, his search went on for lost secrets of Maya technology. With the collected field data, he was able to utilize digital tools along with his creative engineering skills to verify feats of Maya engineering and virtually reconstruct the mysteries of Maya engineering technologies. His breakthrough revelation in Maya engineering projects was the discovery of the ruins of a Maya suspension bridge, and proof of the existence of this bridge is the topic of a History Channel production. His discoveries in Maya technology have been recognized in National Geographic magazine and the monthly magazine of the American Society of Civil Engineers, in addition to other scholarly publications. His ability to reverse engineer complex distressed buildings and identify the cause of the distress has enabled him to discover, dissect, analyze, and reconstruct lost Maya technologies. He brought all these talents to the research and the writing of his book entitled The Lost Secrets of Maya Technology. You can visit his website at theoldexplorer.com, and his book is also available on Amazon. At the top of the show, we'll have our Starseed News segment with Anastasia, bringing current events of interest to Starseed, and we're going to have a brief visit from our friend Renee Barnett to share more details about her upcoming excursion to France. We want to thank Chris for hosting the switchboard this evening, and we invite you to call in with questions or comments tonight, and that number is 917-889-8292. And then remember to press 1 on your keypad so we know you want to come on the air. If you like our show, we encourage you to click follow on our show page. You'll get our show notices, and it will help promote our show and guests. And then do remember to tell a few friends about us. For our new listeners, our main site is starseedhotline.com, where we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our vault of knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. And we'd also like to thank Rose, Anastasia, and Sahar for their continuing great work and dedication on behalf of our Starseed forum. You can also find us on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. And we'll get started in just a moment, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. Our Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone session available with Lavendar, Anastasia, or myself. If you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by getting your solar return timing. Please allow 2 weeks ahead of time to make sure that you do get it in time. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Anastasia. Hang on. Okay, Anastasia, I got your mic open now. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening here.
Hello.
Well,
great to be on tonight.
Pardon?
It's going to be a great show tonight.
It certainly is. We have Jim on the line, and he will be coming on very soon. We're going to do our new segment first. And as I said, we are really, 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 really glad that Mercury's going direct tonight, because this has been an exceptionally quirky kind of 3 weeks here, and I know that we're all happy about that.
It's goodbye and good riddance.
Yeah, really. And also, do you have, I don't want to usurp your news stories, but are you going to talk about the meteor shower?
A little bit.
Okay, we talked about that a little bit last week.
Go ahead and speak up about it. I mean, anything you got to tell us is great.
Well,
I kept
was just
the segment.
Going to
yeah, go ahead.
Mention that we did talk about it last week, but it I believe the peak is on August 12th.
Yes.
So if you live, if you can get away from the city lights, it should be a pretty good show. And
is Renee on the line?
I have to take a look.
I think she's an 818 number.
Yeah, I don't see it yet. I don't see it yet, but I'll keep looking.
Okay.
I do want to make a little quick announcement here that if you have had your starseed confirmation or a stage 2 reading with either Lavendar or myself, and you have the markings for crystal mastership, if you were told that in your reading, we do have a few spots still available on our Arkansas Crystal Quest coming up in October. So I just wanted to make that little announcement. If you're interested on going on a crystal quest to go dig crystals in Arkansas and you have the markings, let us know. You can email me at crystals, CRYSTALS, at starseedhotline.com. And let me know you're interested, and I'll send you more information. Okay, Anastasia, the Starseed
hey.
News lady.
Well, it's just good to be on again tonight. The weeks fly so fast. I just can't hardly believe it's another Tuesday night. So
really?
It's great to be with everybody. Does time go fast for you guys as well?
Oh,
it seems to fly.
It speeds. You know, we're putting in like 14 hours a day, so believe me, it's speeding.
Indeed,
by.
Absolutely. Well, I want to say hello to all of our Starseed listeners. I thank you so much for your wonderful emails and keeping in touch, and bless all of your hearts. You're real good about writing, and I want to thank you. We're going to just kind of cut to the news tonight because we have this guest on, and I don't want to cut our time short with him. It's going to be a great show, so I've got a few news items that I want to highlight for everybody tonight, and I want to start by telling what I found out about UFO sightings in Missouri. Apparently, it's a hot spot for UFO sightings right now, and any of our listeners that live in Missouri, particularly around Cape Girardeau or southern Missouri, I would love to hear from you if you have any sightings to report. Apparently, dozens of witnesses last week saw a very strange object that was hovering in the night sky around Cape Girardeau, and they said it was round and red with white blinking lights. And interestingly, the eyewitnesses said, now they know the difference between an airplane and what they were looking at, and it wasn't an airplane, and they don't know what it was. So anybody in southern Missouri that's having these sightings, I would really appreciate hearing from you, and you can write me at anastasia@starseedhotline.com, okay? So also I wanted to bring up, you know, it seems like every week now I've been mentioning that certain governments are releasing their UFO files, and I discovered out of the Sydney Morning Herald recently, in fact this was on the 4th of August, that Australia is beginning to release some of its UFO files. Now, I don't think the documents are extensive, but for those of our listeners in Australia, you might be interested to know that. So they're just available. Apparently, Australia has a 30-year rule where they hold papers or things that are restricted. Anyway, this 30-year rule is up. And so they've released some recent records, not recent, these are old records, but they've recently released these records for public viewing. So anyway, those of you living in Australia can check that out. It should be available in your public database. And that's interesting because that's about, what is it, Ariel, maybe the third country I've mentioned in the last month that's been releasing its UFO files?
Well,
it has been,
we just add them to the list because there's a lot of European countries already that have
there
done
are.
That
yes.
2 years ago.
Yes,
so,
but it's just a steady
right.
thing happening.
Right, one
so,
by one.
Uh-huh, very interesting. Okay, so we want to talk about the sky. Everybody probably is aware that we had a Mars landing. It was early in the early hours of Monday morning, and I watched that live, and that was great. And I was recollecting that I'm going to give away my age here, but when I was younger, I watched watched us land on the moon, and I was watching us land on Mars the other evening. So that's pretty exciting. And they released photos taken from the Curiosity, the vehicle. It's on a NASA website, and even though it's dusty, it's very interesting. It's really very mysterious, kind of a faint yellow-orange with mountains in the distance, and so we can see now from a camera, we can see what Mars looks like, and that's pretty exciting.
So it sure is.
Yeah, it really is, and gee, we just need hours and hours to talk about stuff like this, but that's the highlight. So if you want to go to NASA.gov, you can pick up images of that, or spaceweather.com is another place that has a couple of pictures of it, but that's something that I think you'll all want to take a look at. And also, on the sun, by the way, we're expecting some solar flares and activity, magnetic eruptions here in the next day or two. We're having some CMEs come from these coronal ejections from the sun, and they're expected to hit the Earth magnetic field probably tomorrow. So they won't be too big. They might be C3s or such, but the sun continues to be very active right now. And also, what's really fascinating, if you can check this out on the internet, they found a sun serpent, and this is amateur astronomers that found this. But it's this gigantic filament of magnetic energy on the sun. And to see a photo of it, it's beautiful. I mean, it's just this beautiful sort of serpentine, dark red, flowing current on the sun. And they said that if you stretched it out, if one of the filaments were on the Earth, the other end of this filament would reach all the way to the moon. So that's how big it is. It's really, really huge. Mm-hmm. And so they said if it collapses, it would crash into the surface of the sun and spark a powerful type of explosion that they call a Heiter flare. So they're monitoring the developments on that. There's just a lot of some very interesting things happening on our sun, and that bears us to watch it, I feel. Now, we've got some upcoming near-asteroid encounters, and these aren't too close to us, fortunately. We had one on July 25th. It was only 8.5 lunar distances from us, but coming up this month on the 12th, we have one passing close to us that's 37 lunar distance. That's the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So that's 37 moon widths away from the Moon to the Sun to Earth. Excuse me. Another one on the 21st, which is 58.5 LD, and another one on the 25th, and then again on the 26th. So we have a bunch of meteors passing by here, not to mention the Perseids that are going on. And you know, I did not realize this, but the Perseids are connected to the comet Swift-Tuttle. Had you heard mm-hmm. that, Ariel?
Yes.
Or you knew that? Okay.
Yes, and I'm wondering if the heavy meteor activity is because we're passing through this debris zone.
Well, now that's a very good question. I think that I would say probably not, although maybe the mainstream may claim that, but we have had so many fireballs in the sky and so many things going on this year alone. Now, maybe that's true, but there are apparently other factors connected to that that maybe are not being discussed, but there is definitely a really high level of activity in the sky with incoming meteors, fireballs, and things like that, that I don't know that we can say is connected to the Perseids. It may be something else. But there's a lot of action going on that way, and a lot of fireballs are still continuing to be seen in the skies all around the world. Now, they said that this is a particularly favorable Perseid year, and even though I'm not really sure why, but they say that the meteoroid concentration is absolutely the densest, like you said, Ariel, on the 12th of August, and they say that's when they're going to put on their best show. So any starseed out there that are keeping an eye on the skies and want to write to me about what they've seen. I know certain locations across the planet are particularly brilliant, and some of you will really be seeing a great show. And I hope you're going out to check the skies. It's worth it. If you can get away from the city lights and observe this, it's going to be real special.
It is, getting away from the city lights, and if the moon is not, I,
don't know exactly what phase the moon will be in on the 12th, but if the moon is not at full, you know, not
I think it's going to be a crescent.
Okay,
which,
so that is
which,
one of the most favorable, exactly.
Right.
I went out 1 year and saw 166, streaking meteorites through the sky in 1 hour, 166.
Mm-hmm.
It was thrilling. So everybody check that out.
It's just so exciting when that happens, and everybody make a wish.
Okay,
I really believe in that, and I love to do it, and it's a delightful thing to do. So go out and make your wishes. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that we're coming into a blue moon this month, and that's fun. And that's when we get a second full moon in a month. It happens about once every 3 years, actually. Technically, they say it's once every 2.66 years. But,
so that's why it's once in a blue moon, so it's
right,
not very
exactly
often.
Right, exactly, that,
uh-huh.
Right. And it's going to happen this time on the 31st of August. So we had one on August 1st, and we're going to get another one on the 31st. So what an exciting time for the skies. You know, this is just we've had an amazing year with configurations and just all kinds of wonderful things happening. It's really exciting. It's really a great time to get a telescope.
It is.
It'd be
sure
a wonderful thing to
mm-hmm.
have an amateur telescope and set one up and just kind of watch all this stuff. It's very exciting. So that's it for tonight. I wanted to make sure we had enough time for Renee and for our guest, and I want to thank you for just letting me share these few things with you.
Well,
and I'm looking forward to the show.
It's very, very fascinating and good research there. Thank you so much, Anastasia. And Lavendar, I do not see Renee on the switchboard as of yet. So
I wonder if she forgot.
Well, you know what? The show must go on, and once I bring our very special guest on, we won't be stopping. So let me just do one more.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the Tetons while you do that.
Okay.
I got a phone call from our friend Barbara, who is the ranger that protects the Grand Tetons up there in Wyoming, and she told me that the mountain's been hit 2,000 times by lightning this past week, and that's real unusual. So that's just, you know, more confirmation of things that are happening at the Tetons. And the meetings are still going on, and it looks like they're probably in just right after August 20th, which will be the 25-year anniversary of August Harmonic Convergence when we have this grand trine in fire. So exciting things are still happening in Wyoming at the Tetons.
2,000
wow.
strikes in a month. Did you say 2,000?
2,000 in a week.
In a week. My goodness, that's amazing.
It struck the mountain. And did not cause any fires.
Oh, that's amazing. That's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
And normal, I believe Barbara said that normal is 2 or 3 lightning
yeah.
strikes a week. Is
yeah.
that what she
wow.
said?
Wow.
And this last week there was 2,000. So, yeah,
wow.
there's a hand in that one somewhere.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'll be thinking
okay.
about that for a while. Okay.
Yeah. I don't see Renee on the switchboard.
Okay.
So with great pleasure now, I would like to introduce Jim O'Conn. Jim, welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. You're on the air. Hello, Jim. Hang on a second. Jim, I've clicked the wrong button. There you go. See, Mercury is still messing with my brain. I'm sorry, Jim. I clicked the wrong button.
Can you hear me now?
Jim O'Conn, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you ladies. I'm
well,
very impressed by
you.
Your knowledge of the... Now...
Uh-oh.
Hello. Jim, we can't hear you, and I did not click a button. Hello? Anastasia?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Lavendar, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. We're doing a count here. Jim, we can't
Hello?
Hear you. Let me. Oh, there you are. Okay.
There you are.
Yes, something happened. Maybe it was Mercury again.
Yes, Mercury retrograde. Believe me, that's why we're so glad, you know, when it gets over with tonight. So let's try this again. Welcome so much to our show, and we are really looking forward to hearing your story. And Lavendar, do you want to lead us off?
Yes, I will. Jim, so glad that you took the time to be with us tonight. And I'm looking at this book right now and the front cover of it, The Lost Secrets of Mayan Technology. And whoever did the cover, oh, what a wonderful, wonderful picture. And I spent some time down in the Yucatan, so I just really, really, really want to hear everything you have to say. And I guess we need to start with, why did you write this book?
That is a good starting question. I've spent over 40 years as a amateur and then as a more knowledgeable person studying the Maya. And during those years, and for the first 20 at least, I was asking questions of the archaeologists who were excavating and restoring the sites about the technology. And they said, what technology? I said, well, the tall buildings, the water systems, the concrete, all the structures. I said, there's lots of different technological systems here. And they said, these were Stone Age people. They couldn't do those things. I said, look at them. There they are in front of us. So one by one, and the first one was, the first big one was the bridge at Yaxchilan, which was on the intro. And that bridge was sort of a culmination of all the parts of my technology. Now, I work backwards in the tools and the way they invented cement 2,300 years before the Europeans, their structures and their bridges and their roads and their water systems and on and on and on, until I had enough to do a book. And I doped out all the different methodologies. And what you have in your hand is the result of my exploration and my investigation of the different sites and different methodologies of technology.
Well, the Mayan civilization was the longest in history. For 3,000 years, the Maya had a long time to contemplate the cosmos and develop their cosmic philosophy. How did this assist in developing their scientific civilization? And can you explain their cosmic philosophy?
Yes. I heard you a few minutes ago talk about NASA and Mars and the moon and asteroids coming within certain LDs, I like that, of the Earth. And the Maya had, look, we were, you know, 235 years ago, we declared independence as a country. Just think we had 2,000 years before we reached our golden period, as they did. They had 2,000 years to study the sky, and they were fascinated with the sky, with the stars and the planets and all the visitors that we talk about, the comets and the planets, et cetera. And they became more obsessed with the sky and the heavens than any other civilization that we know about. And over time, as they become familiar with stars and planets, et cetera, and started tracking them, they needed systems to count the periods of days that Mercury took, or Venus took, or Mars took to circumnavigate the sun. And they developed mathematics from that, and they developed astronomy, they developed chronology, the horologists, they were great timekeepers, and of course, they developed one of the five original written languages on Earth to track and record their findings. So during this period, they had a lot of trial and error. 2,000 years is a lot of time to work on a system, a time when they were able to work on their sciences and not be interfered with by, like, Rome. There was no barbarians at the gate down the Yucatan. In the isolation of the Yucatan, they developed unbelievable sciences that were way beyond the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians, and developed a system that set up their civilization, that developed, let's say, classes and societies, they needed, they needed buildings. They started building buildings and erecting cities, and then the cities needed water systems and road systems and tall buildings and bridges, et cetera. If I'm going too fast for you, it's like their study of the stars led to their sciences, and the sciences led to a society that needed to build great cities. And these high-rise cities were the result of the technology, which is an applied science rather than a true science like mathematics or astronomy or writing. And they put it all together and had an amazing a civilization that nobody knew about. Even when they failed, about 900 due to a natural disaster. And we being the Europeans, but also we are Americans like they were, we didn't discover that part of our heritage was this great civilization that was failed some 800 years before we became a nation. So that's how it started. And one of the things that they really concentrated on was their cosmic philosophy. The Maya put the stars, put the cosmos into a quadrant system, a quadpatriot system. And they developed a vertical system of four different directions. So when they thought about time and space, they had four dimensions. They had X, Y, and Z, like we would do it in our algebra or calculus. But they also added time. So when they calculated a point or an event in time and space, they had four dimensions that they actually calculated. Now, well, the only thing we have that's even close to that, that we think about, is our space-time continuum, where we use at least four coordinates, but up to 11 with string physics. We won't get into that one, but they were really advanced and just developed the most incredible scientific system in the world.
So about the bridge, tell us more about what methods did you use to prove the existence of the bridge?
Well, I discovered the bridge when I was going downstream in a dugout canoe and saw the two ruins in the river. The ruins were of the major pylons or piers. And being a civil engineer, a structural engineer, I recognized the footprint of a long bridge. And looking at the city of Yaxchilan, that was the name of the city there, they had built this city on this great big oxbow in this broad river, and the oxbow was like an omega. And at the wide part, it was like 3 kilometers across, and back where it all came together was only like 500 meters, like 5 football fields across. But it was tall hills, and it was very hard to access. So during the rainy season, which was 6 months a year, we had 6 months of flood. And they couldn't cross the river because the river, instead of being 300 feet wide, became 600 feet wide. And moving at 10 to 15 miles an hour with huge trees floating down the river, and they were, because of the curve in the oxbow, they had extra speed from the water because of centrifugal forces. So they had to figure out a way to cross the river. And my first step with archaeologists was to say, look, this big city with 50,000 people was in this isolated chunk of land surrounded by the river. And all their polity, their land and their little villages and their agriculture was across the river, and they could not get across during those 6 months. And canoes wouldn't work. The speed of the water and everything else, I won't go into the details, but they needed a bridge. And that was where you prove anything to anybody. First of all, there was a need. And they used all the parts of my technology that I explained in the book to put together their masterpiece. They used cement to make castle-based concrete, and they integrated their stonework with the concrete to make composite structures. And at the top of this 75 or 80-foot high tower, they put the arches in to hold the ropes, and they used ropes by the way, is a suspension structure. And you say ropes, well, they're 18,000 PSI. That's 18,000 pounds per square inch in tension. Well, that's as strong as a steel member, but they don't last as long. You got to replace them every year. So I developed digitally a virtual structure based on what I found in the field and what I developed through the computer. I found absolute marvelous structure, actually, on the plaza that lined up exactly with the two structures in the river. Now, people say, why didn't you? Well, this is the river, by the way, is the separation between Guatemala and Mexico. But during the time I was investigating, there was a civil war in Guatemala, and the terrorists, or call them the guerrillas, had mined the Guatemalan side with flash mines and all kinds of booby traps. And several people had been killed, and I decided I was very interested in my technology, but I was not going over there where they had and we're still putting in landmines. So I only investigated the river and the Mexican side, which did not have any landmines. But it all came through with great color renditions and a 3D fly-through, which was used by the History Channel to tell the story of my technology and the world's longest bridge in the ancient world at Yaxchilán.
Wow. So give us a little bit more about your adventures and how did you live, and tell us about some of the things that happened to you as you traveled on these expeditions.
Well,
get involved with snakes and wild animals and predators and gorillas and things like that?
Well, I'm not afraid of snakes. I'm very careful. I respect snakes. And the wild animals are real, but they do not bother you because, you know, they're not hostile. The worst thing besides gorillas is the mosquito, is insects. They will carry diseases and they will fly down one of the predators called the botfly, which will fly down and just barely land on you and take off. And while he touches you, she lays her eggs beneath your skin, and will a maggot, her larvae, will grow. And you don't know. You think it's a bug bite for a few days, and then you start feeling something crawl under your skin. And you have what turns out to be, in the end, of like an inch-long larvae growing under your skin.
Oh.
It's not going to kill you, but it still feels creepy.
Wow. And can I ask you what the Mayans might have done to protect themselves? Was the ecosystem different back then?
No, it was the same, and they had the problems with the botfly. Now, in the old days, they used to wait, I'm talking about 10 years ago, maybe 15, until they could get it to a point where they knew that it was a botfly, and they would cut an incision in and pull out the insect. Even the Mayans did it. They had very sharp blades. But now, I don't know who discovered it, but they found if you take a piece of bacon, lay it over the insect mound, as it were, or tape it down or something, that little critter will come crawling out into the bacon, and it's gone in a day. So
wow.
It's just like the people that get bitten by the most deadly snakes in the world, the Fer de Lance, in the same area. They used to just, you know, get a bottle of tequila and throw the cap away and drink to their friends in the half an hour they were gone. Somebody discovered if you take a laser gun, a taser gun, and just make zap it once and then turn it 90 degrees and zap it again, it will somehow detoxify the venom. And you don't have to worry about going to even get venom shots.
Wow.
And so any venom toxin anyway. So there are certain ways to get out of it, but it was, you know, my encounter with gorillas was sort of dangerous when I was dealing with the Guatemalans, because they thought I was CIA, but we did slip out in the middle of the night. But a more funny story is when I had to go through the Zapatista lines in the early 90s. They were in Chiapas, and I remember coming into Marco and with the all wore ski masks, and he had a pipe, and it was all in all the news. So, but I had to go through there because we were doing research, and I had one archaeologist with me, and we got to the lines, and we'd already gone through the Mexican army lines. And they were very formal, and we gave them a letter of permission and our letter of safe conduct. And we got to the Zapatistas. They were all, informal and wanted to know what we were doing. And we told them we were just archaeologists going down the river. And then I pulled out a carton of Marlboro cigarettes and a bottle of tequila. We became their best friends.
Uh-huh.
They loved that. I'm telling you, they loved that. The tequila's okay, but they love those Marlboro cigarettes. So I was trying to, tell them, listen, tomorrow's my birthday. Tomorrow's my birthday, and that's the same day as Emilio Zapata, the famous leader of the revolution. He's born in 1885, a little before me. And I tried to tell them, listen, I was born on the same birthday, and can you make me an honorary Zapatista? They weren't paying attention to me. They were splitting up the cigarettes, and so I just took off and went down to the river and got a canoe and took off down to Yaxchilan. I may have made that too long, but those are good stories.
Those are good stories. Could I ask you if this place where the bridge was is anywhere near that new temple that they have found? If they call it El Zotz in Guatemala. Do you know about that? The Temple of the Night Sun?
Yeah.
I guess they uncovered it in 2009. Is that near where you were?
Not really. It's a few hundred miles away because we're at the very limit of the border of Guatemala and Mexico. So we're down a bit to the north, but they're down near or beyond Tikal, which is a couple hundred miles away.
Okay.
So they're, I have not visited that site.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, Lavendar.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
So I'm curious to know what you think about what kind of tools do you think they had, and do you think they had some extraterrestrial help? Were they more space age than what we've been told?
Well, they really were smart. And I'm talking about cognitive intellect. And they really thought that they could communicate with the stars and beyond. Okay, this is in the book, but they really were keen on, communicating with the universe. But as far as I know, and I've not seen any evidence that they had any contact with extraterrestrials that help them develop their sciences and their technology, because they had so much time that they worked things out on their own. Now, 2,000 years is a lot. This thing, like I talked about us being 235 years old as a nation, just thinking 2,000 years, how if we don't do something with ourselves, I always preempt that, because some people always say, well, what if we do so-and-so? Well, if you have 2,000 years more, I mean, you're talking about seeing man walk on the moon. I mean, it's already been 40-something years since we had a man walk on the moon. I mean, and we were sending robots to Mars. This Curiosity was just fascinating. I don't know if it's worth $2.5 million, but, Curiosity killed a cat, right? But we don't know what will happen there. But I am really – I think that's a better way to go. Let's get back to Maya, though. Okay. They had some certain limitations. They didn't have any beasts of burden. They didn't have a horse. They didn't have a cow. They didn't have anything they could pull a wagon with. That's why they didn't use wheels, because it was better to use manpower. But the part that we may be talking about is – the tools. They did not have metal or iron, let's take iron specifically, within 1,500 miles. And, people didn't get around in those days. That was a long way for them to travel, and the people who were in that zone never discovered the iron ore that they had. But the Maya had something really special. they had one of the two sources on Earth of jadeite. There's a tectonic plate, and you know, you got one going through New Madrid there, okay, in Missouri. I was thinking of your town there. Anyway, and that tectonic plate produces jadeite. Jadeite is a material that is harder than iron and harder than steel, except for stainless steel. And they found a way to work it, and they made tools that were absolutely clones. And we made clones of their tools because their chisels and their gouges and their awls and their hammers and hatchets were identical to the shape, the ergonomic and the practical shape that we use for steel tools today. If you had a chance to look in the book, you can see pictures, photographs of these tools that are, they're just like, you could compare them to modern tools. Their chisels look like our chisels, but nobody, this is the part that's amazing, archaeologists didn't care about the Mayan tools. They saw these unbelievable sculptures. They have three-dimensional bas-reliefs, everything you can imagine, and the great cities with the stonework and the tall buildings and the pyramids, the palaces and the temples. And they never said, now, what kind of tools do they use? And they said they were stone, like flint. Well, the stone that they're using is harder than flint, so that wouldn't have done a very good job. And if you've seen, and the book has many pictures of Maya sculpture, it is unbelievably exotic. It's otherworldly, and it's just beautifully executed. I mean, it's just so precise, it's unbelievable. They did this with jadeite tools. And go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I just wonder, did you discover the jadeite tools? I mean, is that how, when was this discovered that they used jadeite? This is really interesting. I'd never heard that before.
Well, comments came from, I had four eminent archaeologists that reviewed the book. I can't believe, reviewed the manuscript. And they sent me back notes in the margin and things like, is this real? I'm talking about the tools now. Is this an artifact or is this a copy? And I tell them, they call me up or email me, and I say, no, it's a real thing. And a man named Felipe Kleinfelter, who I met at the site of Yaxchilan, he flew in 1989, in his plane, and then we sat down and started talking about Maya tools, and I had never thought about them. And I'm only, a part-time archaeologist. Archaeologists who spent their life on these sites never thought about the tools and just assumed they had something that was doing some unbelievable stonework. So we sort of joined up and became friends, and we still are. And chapter six, which is the tools, is all about Felipe and his search. And I joined him in the search. I went to places where jadeite is found in the Montegua Valley in Guatemala. In fact, it was so rare to find this, because there's 60-ton boulders, now that we know where it is, of this jade, that in the early part of the last century, until 1950, archaeologists were told by geologists that there was no jadeite in the Americas. And all the jade was imported from China. I mean, give me a break. The Mayas imported jade from China. And Maya civilization fell apart, it wasn't an empire. This was a big business civilization. The business for making tools and making jade, jewelry and costumes, etc., fell apart. And when the collapse came and 98% of the people became fatalities, they forgot how to make the jade tools, how to make the jade jewelry, lapidaries fell out of business. And the location of these mother loads of jadeite were completely forgotten. So when the Spanish came and saw the Aztecs with jade, now the Aztecs didn't come along for like 300 or 400 years after the collapse of the Maya. So they used Maya antiques as their jade, and the Spanish found these and thought they were part of the Aztec bag of tricks, but it wasn't. And in Europe, which then after they discovered the Maya and they already knew about the Aztec, they assumed, because nobody knew where the mother lodes were for jadeite, that they were all imported from China. And that's the truth. I mean, that's unbelievable. When I was going to college, I remember that this is in the 50s, that the people told me there was no jade in the Americas. And I said, there's got to be. No, it was all imported from China. I'm going, that's crazy. Now, that's weirder than having an alien come in, extraterrestrial. I mean,
can I ask you,
it was easier to fly here in a spaceship than it was across the Pacific in a boat. Anyway, that's took the jadeite and made it into their tools, their jewelry, everything that was, and they knew ways of working this. And Felipe, my colleague, developed methods of king the jadeite that was just like the Maya. So he's an expert. Hello?
Hello.
Hey.
Okay, well, I'm still here.
Well, you know, I was just thinking about all of this. Did you actually unearth these tools? Did you find tools? Did you discover the tools or chips, pieces of tools?
Yes. Let me tell you what.
Hammerheads and things like that?
I didn't find any large tools, but I went. Felipe and I discovered at least two Maya workshops where they made lapidaries, made jewelry, and made the tools. And we could dig under the surface of the soil. I mean, they were halo farms now. You know, they were growing blue agave and stuff like that. And we could then pull up handfuls of these chips. They called debitage of jadeite, which was chipped off to make a tool.
Sure, to make something. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And he found were just, they were scattered. Earlier, archaeologists say they were all over the sites, but people picked those up and took home as souvenirs. I mean, Mr. Average tourist. But they occasionally we'll see one in a museum, and they'll call it ceremonial implement or something like that.
Hmm.
We're the first ones to really break through, and it was all based on Felipe's research.
That's really a big deal. And you said that somebody you know has used these as tools to see what they'll do?
Felipe. Felipe is an international sculptor. That's why he was interested in their tools.
Well, how fascinating.
And so he's used the tools to do carvings that are on. And then two or three pictures of those are in the back of the color pages in the book. So
has mainstream archaeology caught up with you? I mean, are they teaching this? Is this accepted? Are you the lone announcer of this? How is that being received?
Right now, you're talking to the Lone Ranger. But actually, I'm only Tonto. Felipe is
yours.
Lone Ranger, and I'm the one that I have the platform. So he works with me, and he's archaeologists can't believe it that these things really exist because they're in museums, they're laying on sites. You find them in markets. You go to Chichicastenango or to different markets around Mexico, Guatemala, and they'll be on sale just in a case, and they're not considered pre-Columbian art.
Tool fragments. You're talking about tool fragments.
No, they're complete tools.
Wow.
I see them all the time right there in the laying on a table. I'm not talking about a fancy market. I'm talking about a native market, an Indian market.
So they're still currently using these as tools?
No. They don't know their tools.
Okay, they don't know what they are. Okay, gotcha.
The reason they quit making them is because it's so much easier to buy or make iron tools.
Wow, that's just fascinating. That's amazing. Amazing. And I don't suppose anyone has ever known jadeite. You're the first to discover that this is, that tough and that, able to cut into stone. Nobody else has figured that out.
No, it was known because the geologists knew about the jewelry and the other incredible pieces of art that the Maya made, like death masks and stuff like that, out of jadeite. And they had already measured the properties on, like, the Moore scale, which is the hardness scale, where, soapstone 0 or 1 and a diamond's 10. And these come in, like, at 7.
Wow.
Iron is 4 to 5. So,
that's just amazing. Jadeite is one of my favorite stones.
But nobody found the tools until we came along.
Well, that is really quite the find. That's quite the discovery. That's really amazing.
Archaeologists,
that's a big deal.
They haven't recognized it yet. They have not said these are tools.
Well, you're a pioneer.
Thank you. It's fun being a pioneer.
Take them up a little bit.
Lavendar, do you have more questions?
Yes, I'd like for him to tell us a little bit about the filming project that they carried out where they were testing the capabilities of the Mayan cement.
Right. I had already done some papers on how the Maya made this wood structure. I'm going to call it a structure because it's a circular cylinder of like 3-foot-long logs like we could build a fire. But it's got a center hole all the way down to the middle. It's like 20 feet in diameter and maybe 12 feet high. And on top, they would stack chunks of limestone. And they had a methodology. They'd start the fire in the middle, and this device actually was a thermodynamic reactor that caused the interior, when the fire started, interior chamber to become hotter and lower the temperature, you know, high temperature, low pressure, and it would suck air in from the outside, fresh, cold, oxygen-rich air, and add to the interior combustion chamber, and it would recycle and get hotter and more air would be pumped in until they had witnesses. I've had this out of old archaeological logs. I thought they were making this mortar. Didn't know they were making cement. There was a 120-foot high diameter, a 4 or 5 foot diameter tongue of flame reaching in the sky. And the color was bluish white. Now, that's a strange color to come out of wood, but if you know anything about physics, bluish white color is somewhere around 1400 to 1500 degrees, and when you know the wood burns at like 600 degrees Celsius, by the way. They had developed a method to increase the firing temperature of wood to the point where it would melt limestone. And when limestone melts, it becomes cement. That easy. I mean, it's not that easy, but it's that simple. The Romans had cement, but that was taken out of the ground from a natural cement that was formed by Mount Vesuvius and other volcanoes. So the Maya carried this on from like 300 BC through. I even see them today, and I'll, I see the guys making them. They use them sometimes to make cement to repair the mounds of the structures, the Maya ruins. Now, I ran into some really great Mexican scientists who were testing my theory of the bridge, and they were going to prove it was impossible. Well, they took samples of these very structures that I was talking about and had been investigating, but I couldn't take samples because the National Archaeological and Historical Institute wouldn't let any gringo take any samples. So they had sanctions, and they went in, took samples, and found that this was really good, solid cement. It was like almost as strong as our normal cement, not really high strength, like 2,500 PSI, but it had all the characteristics, the chemical characteristics, and the physical characteristics of modern Portland cement. Now, that really helped me a lot, because now I have a cement that tied together all these rocks that made these tall buildings and these bridges and everything. And then when we did the History Channel, we're getting to that part now, they asked me to make a scale model. Well, it wasn't going to be a scale model at first. I actually considered making a 20-foot diameter, 12-foot high one in Felipe's backyard of his studio in Austin, Texas. And we just decided that if we got one of those kilns really going and it shot flames 100, 150 feet in the air, we would be put in jail by the fire department. So we made a small 4-foot diameter, about 2 feet high model, and only burned for, the real big ones burned for like 30 hours because you have a way of warding them down, et cetera. So ours burned for only like 45 minutes. But we got up to 800 degrees Celsius, which is like double the temperature of wood burning, and we actually melted or started some of the limestone starting to melt and turn into cement. But the real clincher was the color of the fire. In fact, it shot straight up in the air. Like, remember the end of Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark? How the ark has a great tongue of fire going in the sky to burn all the Nazis up. Well, it looked like that. There's a picture of it in the book. So they filmed that. The producers of the History Channel, and the Maya had certain rules about making the modern Maya also making cement. They had to have perfect weather and had to have a certain situation, and no women were allowed. And I've asked people about why women weren't allowed, and they said, well, they considered the fire and the method of making cement to be a feminine object, like sailors in a ship. They always call her, and remember, it used to be like for voting to have women on board the old sailing ships. And we had several women in the crew, the camera crew, and I decided to let them stay. God, I'd rather face the wrath of a Mayan god than a liberated woman in modern day and time. And I had this line, and I got away with it, and nothing. I had this line in there, the old Satchel Paige line. Y'all may remember, or may not remember, the famous old baseball player who said, "Don't never look back, because something might be gaining on you." They cut that out of the book, but I liked it. So that's how they filmed it. And they went away, and that was it. Next thing you know, it was released on the History Channel.
Well, that's great. When was it aired, and is it going to air again so we can see it?
I don't think so. That was 6 years ago, and I have my copies and all the people involved. And for some reason, that it's not for sale anymore. If they air it, it's going to be something as a surprise, because they took this engineering and empire, which I know you've seen the Greeks and the Romans and the Maya, and they play it over and over again, and it's really great. But they didn't show ours. But you can see segments on YouTube that's got 11-minute segments of the film. There's four of them.
That's good. Let me ask you about what you think of that's going to happen with this December 21st, 2012 calculation that people are talking about. What does it mean to you, and what have you discovered at all the years that you've been researching in the Maya? What do you think's really coming about?
Okay, let's get to the Maya. They're the ones that started this whole thing by inscribing a date on a stele, a monument, at the site of La Tortuga. I'm sorry. I'll get this right. La Tortuguera. I don't know why I just couldn't say that. But it's the only place until recently where this date was inscribed. Now, it's not a calendar, it's a date. And the date says, the date is 13 baktuns. And we converted that, we being archaeology, to the 21st of December 2012. And the message in hieroglyphics says, in the name of a minor god, which I can't remember his name right now, it says, "He shall come down and get dressed." And the rest of the inscription has been destroyed, just eroded. So we don't know if he's going to get dressed for a party or what, but it doesn't have any portention of doom or gloom. Now, another date has just been found in this past year at the site of La Corona in Mexico. And this is not on a stele, it's on some stairs, and it talks about the same date, December 21st of this year. But it's a message of commemoration and good fortune, because the ruler of Tikal, a neighboring city-state, comes and says, even though we've been beaten in battle, which he had, we're going to rule forever. At least we'll be there until the end of this cycle, which is December 21st and the 13 baktuns. Now, how did we get to December 21st? you may know the story about the Maya and their brilliant astronomy, how they calculated the precession of the Earth's axis. Anastasia, I believe you're the expert on astronomy here. You're aware that the Earth's axis is not vertical. It's like at a 17-degree angle, and it has a slight wobble in it.
Yes.
It takes 25,600 years to make one complete wobble, so
it
does take a while. In fact, somebody's talking about, has it moved lately? The last time it moved was during 2004 when a big earthquake occurred in Malaysia that caused the big tsunami.
Affected the wobble.
Yes. Tsunamis, yes. So that was just a one-time thing. It just popped over. But the way they got the date, okay, here they are. Let's say, Anastasia, you're an astronomer. You and I are really happy we found the big number, which is 25,600, and we divided that into five parts, which we call them five creations. That's 5,123 years and 120 days, give or take. And we're saying, okay, let's set up a time to start and finish this thing. Well, where are we? The precession's in a circle, so there's no beginning and no end of a circular entity.
Right.
So they said, look, let's go forward. I'm guessing this is how they did it. And find a day was really good to end, you know, the big day. Unlike when we had the Millennium Party in Y2K, everybody was projecting all kinds of things were going to happen. You know, computers were all going to, you know, break down and go crazy because they couldn't handle the change in the numbers and the dates. So they found a date, a time, and they wanted to pick New Year's. That's December 21st, by the way. It's also the winter solstice, as you know, okay? So that's a big holiday. I mean, that's where we got Christmas and we got Hanukkah. And so the Maya didn't know that these dates existed, but they came up with the 21st of December as their New Year's anyway. But they wanted to pick a time that was portentous for the sky. So they found a time, and these guys are great astronomers, so they could predict the movement of the Milky Way, and they wanted to pick a date when the dark trough, the womb, as they call it, or the alligator, or crocodile, of the Milky Way was aligned with the zenith of the sun on that day. And they picked December 21st, 2012, and it's really going to, we're going to be aligned on that day with
it's
the
accurate.
Milky Way. Right.
Yeah, so, amazing, just amazing.
And they said, Anastasia, when did all this start? When did we start the creation? Well, that's easy. We're Maya. We believe in the linear time, and we believe in cyclic time, like history repeating itself. You know, they say remember the future and anticipate the past. I always love that. Mm-hmm. So we went back 5,128 days and 123 days to the year 3,111, and it's on August 11th, and I believe it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I always throw that in. But we don't have any idea what they measured the day in. So they picked that date as their beginning of the creation. And the end was this coming December. So that's how it got established. We don't know how they really did it, but it is 5,123 years, and they did pick those dates. So, what'll happen? You're really attuned to NASA. Do you get those bulletins several times a day? I love them, too. And I'm an instructional engineer, and earthquakes are part of my game, you know. And I keep the track of the geophysicists, and I haven't seen any particular activities except you were talking about lights over the New Madrid. Sometimes before a big earthquake, mm-hmm. there'll be some extraordinary lights in the sky.
There've been some predictions about the New Madrid getting ready to shake.
I got a lot of buildings in Memphis that I've designed over the years, and I get calls from people. Listen, it's going to go soon. Is my building safe? And I go, as safe as I could have made it. I mean, within budget, you know.
Right.
But anyway, let's get back to December 21st. As far as I can tell from NASA and everything else, we only got the worst fear you're going to have when you wake up is there's only 4 shopping days till Christmas. That's it.
Well, also,
that,
you know, that'll be at 26 degrees galactic center. So a lot of my discovery of star marking is based on 26 Sagittarius, which is December 21st of 2012.
Exactly. I mean, it's a lot of...
Well, we have to remember that our Gregorian calendar is not accurate by any means. That's an arbitrary thing that people picked. And what I find fascinating about the Mayans is their cosmology and seeing the great circle and, you know, the great repeating cycles and looking at it from a cosmic perspective as well as a, you know, an arbitrary human perspective, what you're saying, that they just picked a starting date.
Well,
but
no, they didn't pick a starting date.
They did not.
They picked the ending date. They picked the ending date, and then that was easy to figure the starting date back.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
They knew the amount of years, and they were really unbelievable mathematicians. I mean, there's some of the numbers are so big. It's like there's one that I've seen and read 43 times with 30 zeros behind it.
Well, now, doesn't that make you wonder about really the computing power of the human brain is really probably not that... not that good. Do you have any curiosity about maybe what other influences may have been at play here? I mean, do you ever sit and think, well, how could they do that? I don't think we could do that today. Were they taking some kind of really mystical juice or something to make them that smart? I mean, really, you just have to wonder. Have we degraded? Have we devolved in our intellectual capacity? Because I don't think that people are capable of doing that today. Am I wrong about that?
Well, no, you're correct. You got to have an object or a reason to make a number that large. You got to have a concept to think what will happen in. And the way they did it, they used 13s, like we're talking about 13 baktuns. It was like a row of, 13.13.13.13. And they use what's called a positional system of math. So every time you go up a level, you go up by 20. You're like 20, 400, 8,000, 160,000, et cetera, like that. If you want to look in the book, I've got an example of that, okay?
Did you ever discover one of their mathematical instruments? Or, you know, I mean, did you ever find anything like something they may have used to count or keep track of or anything, you know, that they used to...
No abacus, no slide rules.
Nothing like that.
No, but there may there's at least 4,000 sites that were cities in the Maya realm.
Wow, that's a lot.
So far, we've only investigated around 40.
Wow, really?
That's a lot. I'm talking about really investigating. We get in and dig around, because Mayas did things in layers. You know, they built a pyramid, and another king would come along another few hundred years, build another pyramid on top of that pyramid, and then a third one come along, they'd put a third one up, and they would leave temples buried and
my goodness,
tombs and et cetera. So it takes a lot of digging, and a lot of the countries that have these ruins and these cities aren't giving a lot of friendly permission to dig in their backyard.
Too much political turmoil. Yeah.
Well, they want their own archaeologists to do it.
Can I ask a question? Jim, if you could think of an American state that would roughly equal the size that the Maya civilization covered, I mean,
how
much land are we talking about?
Little Rhode Island.
Are you serious?
125,000 miles, right.
Only the size of Rhode Island, and they had... 4,000 cities?
4,000 sites, yeah. But there were big
sites.
Cities, like 50 big cities, and they had satellite cities. So they were like, I didn't cover the number, the archaeologists did, but I know there's a lot. And I've seen 50 or 60 of them, you know. I mean, and some of them were small, and some of them were really big. So I think Rhode Island is, it may be New Hampshire, but we're not talking about a big area. Just think in your head of Mexico and the thumb, the green thumb sticking out down in South Mexico is the Yucatan Peninsula. It's not that big.
Wow.
I mean, I could drive across it in 4 hours.
Well, now, you mentioned that they didn't have beasts of burden, that they didn't have any horses or anything like that. So in a mental picture of that many cities or, you know, that kind of interconnectedness in a small piece of land, and then my mind goes to the terrain of the jungle as being wet and slippery. And you mentioned, I see from your website, that they had developed a means of making raised roads. Can you tell us about that?
They were called Sakpays. And Sakpay is singular. Sakpayab is plural. And they were 10 meters wide, 30 feet, give or take, and raised a minimum of 1 meter above the jungle floor by a stone wall. And inside was concrete fill. And the top had a smooth paved surface with a crown on it, like you find in modern roads, to let the water drain off. You know, raised up like that to keep the jungle away, and the six-month rainy season allowed them to travel during day or night and rain or not on this absolutely clean in the sense of water, roadway. Now,
amazing.
How many of these do they have? I've explored one that's 300 kilometers long and another one that's 100. Now, the 100-kilometer one that goes from Cabo to Yasuna, These are both near Cancun, so they're in the northern part of the Yucatan. And I found samples or examples of the pavement. It's 4 inches thick, and just after 1,400 years, I had to pick a number because they're about that old. The pieces of the pavement are still there. So, but what is amazing, they've connected the cities. The cities had big trade. Remember I talked about big business before? They had every city had something that another city needed. And they had trade, and they had ideas, and they had culture, and they had these roads ran all over the Yucatan and in Mexico and down in Guatemala and Honduras. And I've cataloged thousands of miles of these. And I'm just going to ask you all ladies the question. In the United States, at the beginning of the last century, which we think, we're sort of 20th century people, right? How many miles of paved road do you think there was in the United States? Paved road in the United States in 1910.
Oh, wow, not much. Not in 1910.
114 miles.
Yeah.
So any one of these roads which I investigated, one was 180 miles long, the other one was 60 miles long, and there's more. Because you can't find these roads. Like, yeah, a city, you could see a city because there's a huge mound of green foliage around it, kind of vines climbing it, et cetera. But the roads are all covered up by jungle and sediment and stuff like that. So you're really lucky to find them when they're making other constructions, like railroads and stuff like that to just blunder onto them.
Can they be picked up by satellite infrared? Can that be spotted from the air?
Actually,
I would think they'd be able to map that.
You can use a optical. Some of them have such a footprint that you could use optical. That means I use Google Earth all the time to look at the roads I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The clarity and the acuity of the Landsat or whatever they're using, Spot 5 satellites, it's clear enough that I could go in and look at some of the areas like I'm 200 feet above the ground. And I can see the trees are still growing in the middle of the roadways, or they've been left, or they're going across lakes or swamps. You can see the telltale signs. And they're straight as an arrow. And that's amazing. They're straight. Boom. The ones I've surveyed go absolutely east-west line, 269 degrees and 59 minutes. That's pretty straight.
Wow.
Let me ask you, Jim, did they use the cement for roads?
Yes. They paved the roads. I thought it said they used cast-in-place.
Okay.
I'm sort of fussy about that, being an engineer. Cement is a powder you mix up with water and rock to make concrete.
Right.
So cement is that dry stuff. Okay.
And did
go ahead there.
No. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, they used concrete to pave the roads.
Wow.
And they made it as they went along. If you were like 100 miles away from a big city and you needed to get to another one and you're halfway, they would find, because the whole Yucatan is a platform of limestone. They dig down 3 or 4 feet,
okay.
You got a mine. They would dig
okay.
up mines of limestone and put it through these kilns and or these reactors I described earlier and make concrete on the
wow.
spot.
Wow. Wow. They were so in touch with the land, the earth.
Absolutely.
They knew what they could use. They used everything available to them. That was going to be my question, was where did they get the lime? And they
the
knew
whole
that.
Area is absolutely, yeah, they have plenty. One thing they have is lots of building materials.
Wow.
The whole lime, the whole Yucatan is covered with it, but 3,000 feet deep.
Well, I can see the fascination with your background as an engineer and all of the huge projects that you've worked on and accomplished in building, you know, landmark structures. To go to an area and study the engineering feats of a civilization that old with only jadeite tools and being able to make use of the environment. Can you describe what you think life would have been like? I mean, as far you said they had plumbing systems, they had water systems, they had road systems.
Yes. They had their big cities. Let's say you're a big city girl, okay? I mean, and now they didn't have a lifestyle as we would have in a big city now. They had a really nice lifestyle. It was better than Europe because Europe was going through the Dark Ages, and it was pretty bad then. But they had the city people, and then they had the hinterland, the close environments, and then the agricultural areas. And they lived pretty much like farmers did, let's say, 100 years ago or something like that, 200 years ago. They had their houses. And remember, this is in the tropics, so they didn't need heat. They didn't need to store food for the winter. So everything had a purpose, and everything was built on a social system, which started at the lower end with the farmers and built up through all the craftsmen and artisans and the technicians and then up to the merchants and the producers and the priests. And I mean, then we get to the lords, the ahus, the kings. So with a system like that, everybody had a want and a need for a building, a road, a certain kind of food or a certain kind of product, which the traders would go out on these roads and go far away. And they had great ships. They had these 60 and 80 foot long, I call them canoes because they were carved out of a tree, but they had all kinds of special design that made them absolutely seaworthy. And that's in the book, too, if you want to look at it. So they had trading going on all down through Central America. See, Central America doesn't start until the Guatemalan border. Mexico's in North America. So most of this was in North America. People think it is in Central America. They had the islands in the Caribbean. They had Florida. They had northern Mesoamerica, and they also had people traveling by foot all over the place to cover the ground. So they had a huge trading network.
And what about their economic system? Did they just barter?
Yes, and they have actually. We found some. Here go again. They don't let me in, but they listen to me. Okay, the archaeologists. A method. of barter, and there's actually somebody found some writing in some of the only four surviving books. Like it was one, they used cacao beans as money. And like, this is just rough, but one bean would equal one egg. Three beans would equal one turkey. Now, they didn't have chickens. They domesticated what we know is our big Thanksgiving turkey now. And it was like four beans for something. I don't have the whole system just memorized, but they use cacao beans and other materials as trade. But they had a system, and they knew if they had some guy bought a big load of corn in, they knew how much each ear of corn was if you traded it for squash, or you traded it for clothes or cotton, woven cotton, et cetera, or for tools or for weapons. And it was all, you know, worked out in the system, and it was domain wide, and that everybody knew what the trade was.
They recently found cacao on a plate of a Mayan excavation in the Yucatan.
Right.
And yeah, that was just recently. The Daily Mail had that article last week. They said it was 2,500 years old. They found that sauce on a plate that they dug up.
And the great thing about that was, it was a sauce. You said it right.
Yes,
They found cacao, they found them in pots, okay, where they were drinking the chocolate out of them, okay? But this is the first time there's been actually a trace of a condiment, chocolate and peppers. It's like a mole sauce, you know, that they use. And
they still have that in Mexico.
Years.
Talk about your hot chocolate.
That's it.
Yeah.
And they use vanilla, all the peppers, chocolate, et cetera, and other kinds of herbs came from the Yucatan. It's unbelievable how it's estimated that 60% of the world food originated with the Maya. Isn't it amazing?
60%.
But anyway, they had all these flavors that they'd flavor up their chocolate with. And I've tasted somebody that made, you probably had mole sauce on chicken and stuff like that. And it's always got peppers in it and sesame seeds and stuff like that. So that's a long history. That takes them back 500 years B.C. or so that they were cooking with chili and chocolate.
Wow. And they had plenty to eat. We assume they had plenty to eat in that rich environment.
Oh, yes.
It sounds like a pretty idyllic culture. So do we know what happened to them?
Technology got them to a point where a land, we told how big it was, that could support only 2 million people, was enhanced with the ability to save and store water and have it for the dry season. Agricultural systems, including raised fields and terraces, that would enable them to produce four times the crop that you could than you could with normal conventional systems, because the soil was not very good there. And everything that they had that grew the population, and it grew out of hand. They had 15 million people by around 900 A.D., and that's about seven times more than the land could stand. And they were all living on a balance. They had like an 18-month supply of water as a safety factor, and they had a year's supply of grain, et cetera. When Mother Nature struck, Mother Nature brought the worst drought in 7,000 years. And this has been proven by a book called The Great Mire of Droughts. He didn't go to the Yucatan. He searched the world, this Richardson Gill, for evidence of similar patterns, because when it's cold in the north, like in northern Europe, it's always a drought in the Yucatan. And during that time, he found examples in Roman and European records of cold. They had a little ice age, things like that, that was really drought, severe drought in the Yucatan. And there's some estimates that it was 44 years to 50 years without water. Well, it didn't take long before people ran out of water and ran out of food. And the estimate is that 97 to 98% died, and about 300,000 survived. Well, the 300,000 was enough to get the culture back on its feet and get the crops going. But it wasn't enough to occupy all the cities. The cities were never occupied again. They were left to the jungle. It takes, as you know, it takes a lot of effort to maintain a city.
Right.
I mean, these people were barely, at the beginning, getting barely to take care of themselves.
And why do you suppose they didn't emigrate? And why did they just stay there and die?
Well,
they were very smart and they had boats, huh?
There's a lot of thought that migration on the boats and walking, but this is a lot of people. And it's like us saying, okay, next week you got to leave Forsyth County, you got to leave Arkansas, you got to Atlanta, and we're going to have to start walking. And we can't do it. Mm-hmm. We don't have the supplies. We don't have any, you know, the survivalists even only have supplies for a year, and they're holed up in their mountain retreats. They didn't have the ability. Some of them did, okay? Maybe a few hundred thousand. That's a lot of people to mm-hmm. go ahead. I'm sorry.
Do we know where they emigrated to? Is there evidence elsewhere in Central or South America that Mayans picked it up again and rebuilt? Any small civilizations that you think are connected?
No, they were the major population in the Aztec, which everybody
right.
confused, didn't even settle down until 300 or 400 years after the collapse. They were a wandering tribe of Chichimecas that finally settled on a island in Lake Texcoco in northern, like 1,500 miles north of the Maya zone. So they weren't even there to take there was no Red Cross. There was no United Way. There was no
mm-hmm.
other countries that even knew they existed. And they just collapsed. They could have started walking, but the drought was not just confined to the Maya zone. It was pretty well spread out, and there's evidence that it was it also affected our Western Hopis and the cliff cultures there. So
maybe that's why they disappeared as well.
That's one of the theories. It was drought
mm-hmm.
that did it. So
mm-hmm.
And there wasn't any other tribe that could come in and take over. Actually, tribe, any other culture, because there was nobody. There were cultures there, but they were affected just like the Maya were. So we don't know.
Well,
but
I
know there had to be some of it.
Well, 15 million people is a lot, and it
yep.
just makes us realize that it's a good reminder that we are all susceptible to climate conditions, and we don't expect it. And, you know, in this day and age, we think we can master the planet, master the climate, and we live in climate-controlled buildings, and we have lots of concrete and ways to get around. But, you know, the planet, she has her own mind. And we're very vulnerable.
One of the problems with the Maya was they did not take care of their environment. Mm-hmm. To make the cement, to build those buildings, to build the roads, they had to tear it. They needed 5 acres of trees to make one cubic meter of concrete, of cement.
Wow.
And they denuded the land. There was all kinds of erosion. The temperature went up, which didn't help when the flood, the drought came. So there was lots of abuses, erosion with over farming. The land was allegedly, according to the paleobotanologist, was actually stripped bare almost.
Oh, wow.
And they had to walk days to get wood to bring back.
So the jungle environment was just stripped away from the cities then. It wasn't what we might imagine it to be. It was
right.
barren.
Because it was a rainforest.
Well, how interesting.
And then it came back after the Maya went back into the land and became a small entity. And it came back to be a rainforest again. But that took 1,000 years.
Wow. Well, you mentioned on your website that they had amazing methods of collecting water and irrigation
yes.
and all of that.
Yes. Well, near the rivers, and there are very few rivers. I'm going to get to the people might be saying, why didn't they just take water out of the river or the lake? Because of the nature of this limestone, it's porous, and the soil is only 3 feet thick. Rainfall would come down and go right into the soil and percolate right down into the limestone and flow into the aquifer, the groundwater. And there are hardly any surface water in the Yucatan. Some cities are lucky enough, like Yaxchilan, we talked about the river, to recidify rivers, and they lasted longer than the other cities. And some were constructed near these natural wells called cenotes, which are, you know, formed by the collision of the bolide or meteorite 65 million years ago that wiped out the dinosaurs. So what we had was the Maya. And because of the fact they only had rain 6 months a year, it was absolutely dry, a virtual desert. The Maya had to devise ways, I'm getting back to your question now, of collecting water during the rainy season and storing it for not only human consumption but for agriculture. So they developed several different methods. I mentioned the cenotes. They didn't have to do anything there except, you know, make sure they could get down to the water level. Then they had something underground, cast-in-place concrete chambers that were called chaltuns. And these chaltuns were underground storage tanks. And depending on the size of the city, they had hundreds of these, which held about 40,000 liters each. So depending on the city and the size of the area, you would put that number of chaltuns, which would give you water plus 18 months of safety. And then you shaped all the ground, and all this is when the land is relatively flat, which it is in the Yucatan. He shaped all the surfaces, the plazas, the buildings, everything, towards these collectors, which are called chaltuns, and save the water during the dry season. The other way was open reservoirs, and this is where they actually had urban microscapes of waterscapes. They shaped the ground. They actually carved the ground in these acropolises, and the buildings would slope all towards these giant reservoirs that were open, some of them holding as many as 29 million gallons. And they were on top of the hills with the temples and the other major buildings, and the Maya had systems of channels and canals that had weirs and stop gates and dams to control the flow of water so it would flow down to the fields during the dry season. And then there was a special place called Palenque, which had more water than it could take. So the Maya designed these beautiful aqueducts underground. This is where we had the water, running water. There was enough pressure in these aqueducts when they narrowed the area of one of these chambers to cause enough head or water pressure to flow up into the palace and make fountains, you know, domestic water and toilets.
Toilets? Wow. We found evidence of toilets?
we found the toilets.
Oh, that's just remarkable. That must, at its peak, it must have been a glorious place.
It must,
as far as
they took these buildings made out of concrete and were faced in beautiful limestone, and then they, in the interior and the exterior, put a coating of stucco, which was made with the same kind of cement they made the buildings with. And then they would add unbelievable sculptures to this and then paint everything, usually a red. We find lots of, including myself, lots of examples of this paint in different places. Everything was painted brilliant yellows and blues and reds and greens, and it was, and wait, they mixed mica with the paint, so they shine.
Wow, you're kidding.
They make an amazing sight. And they also shine in the moonlight. And these are beautiful cities.
Wow.
Well, that is fascinating. And, you know, we could probably talk for another couple of hours. I'm just looking now. We only have about 25 minutes left, and we have callers with questions. So, Jim, are you ready to field some questions?
If I could handle y'all, I guess I could handle the voice from the dark, right? Yes, I'm ready.
Okay. Well, first of all, we have a caller I'm going to bring online right now. Hello, Don. Thank you so much for calling. And, Don, are you there? You're on the air.
Yes, I'm here. How are you doing?
I'm here. Jim's here.
Okay. Don, we can just barely hear you. Can you get up closer to the phone?
Yes. How are you all doing?
We're doing fine, but your volume is way low, so either speak up or put your mouth right on the phone.
Okay, wait one second. Can you hear me better now?
Yes.
That's better, right? That's better.
Yes, much better.
Okay. Yeah, I have a question. What would you say about the Mayan spiritual system? What have you learned about it?
Oh, okay. I made it clear in the beginning of my book, this is a book about technology. All the archaeologists take care of rituals and sacrifices. Now, I'm giggling a little because rituals and sacrifices and the gods, et cetera. The Mayas had a whole host of gods. And, of course, the corn god was the major god. But most of the gods don't even have names. Like there's God K and God G. And it's known what they were gods of, like matriarchy. And Ishtar was a female goddess that was a great protector of women and motherhood and witchcraft, etc. But I only know their names and what their job was as gods. Okay, they're like multi. This was not a mono deity religion. This they had a lot of gods, except there was one chief called Ishtama, and he was the chief gods of the underworld, and everybody sort of bowed to him. But I'm really not. Expert, and I really couldn't even send you to a book where anybody really knows all the secrets of the gods, because the Spanish burned thousands of books when they arrived in Yucatan. And let me tell you, the Yucatan still had Maya, but didn't have the cities. They had states. They had people that could read and write their books. They were killed by the conquistadors, and all the books were burned. Except somehow four survived. It's like closest thing I think would be like war trophies that people brought home, like an enemy helmet or something like that. So we've got four existing in the world, but thousands upon thousands were burned. And the Maya didn't go easy. They took 150 years to defeat them, and the last citadel fell in 1697 when Harvard was 63 years old. So we have a parallel with our history. But the gods, they had merchant gods, they had gods of hunting and fishing, and but as far as the details go, it's really not known very much about the details of the gods, except for like Ishtar.
Wow.
Okay. Well, great, Don. Thank you for calling in, and thank you, Jim. For I know that this the Maya spirituality is probably a subject that has to be mostly conjecture then, because of the absence of the written material.
Well, that was for the gods, but time and space, and time was the number one philosophy that they had that drove all their religion, drove all their political interests, drove every day and every night, and was a bond between earthly items and the cosmos and the stars out there. I mean, they knew so much, it's unbelievable. And they tied it all into the cosmos and the oneness with the cosmos.
Wow, so they were real experts at astrology and those kinds of things, and understanding that.
Practice,
and what an awful genocide occurred, that all of that valuable information was lost, as has been done so many cultures, so many times, again and again, by the status quo in power that, you know, doesn't want any competition, so we just crush it out, wipe it out, and so on. It's a real,
right.
Real shame. It's a real shame.
Well, it was not only the conquistadors were trying to take over, but it was also backed up by the Spanish Inquisition. They were the ones who believed if you threw a non-believer in the water and he drowned, he was back. There he was. If he floated, he was pure. So it was a bad time for everybody.
Yes, indeed.
Well, we have another caller with a question, and we're going to move on. Thank you so much, Don. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, next we are going to hear from Ralph. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. Just wonderful show. I was just wondering, Jim, if there was any indication, I know you didn't mention that they were in contact with extraterrestrials, but I wonder if the pyramids were actually built to represents energy vortexes at all? Are you familiar with that?
The only time that I've ever heard of stargates or energy attraction, I'm not real big into this. I sat with some people one afternoon when it was almost New Year's, so about 1990, and they were waiting to catch a bus to Chichen Itza because they considered Chichen Itza to be a stargate, and the big pyramid there is a collector of cosmic power. I'm not saying it right, I know, but that's the only time that I have read anything. But most of the pyramids and most of the buildings were laid out with astronomy in mind. They were laid out, you know, based on different star groups like the Pleiades, like in sort of a north-south area. They call some of them E groups, where they locate buildings based on a local requirement to, like, what is the Japanese Benshui. Yes, so they had a way of laying their buildings out, which we don't understand yet, okay? There's been some really smart people trying to analyze the geometry of these buildings and the relation to the stars. Now, in the last 2,000 years, you know, the stars have changed, so they aren't exactly what they had back when they laid the buildings out, like Polaris was not another star, it was another star, et cetera. So that's as good as I can help you with, because there's nobody particularly working on, that I know of, working on the cosmic power of the pyramids.
Hmm. Well, I know that most of their history was kind of destroyed, but in your excavation, did you ever see any carvings or sculptures of any type that told of any other type of civilization that maybe preceded them?
We know the civilization. It's called the Olmec. It's called the Mother Culture. And they were parallel with the early Maya. And through independent research on the Olmec and the Maya, there were parallels. The Maya did get some assistance in the notion of writing, because the Olmec had some symbols. But as I said, the Maya developed one of the five original written languages in the world, and they could write anything they could say. In fact, one wag said that they were so complete in their language, it was a Baal-based language, that they could have written Gone with the Wind. So they got some of that idea from the Olmec, which started back around 2,000 or 3,000 years B.C., and they got the idea of the 260-day calendar, which is something we haven't even talked about, but it's not involved in any of these things we've talked about. But there were crossovers, and the Maya on these monuments, like Stelae, have great details about a site or a city, and the city may have 40 or 50 of these different monuments that are unbelievable histories of not gods or some kind of legendary heroes, but real people, real kings and real warriors that won battles and had great empires. But we can read those. Oh, I can't. But the archaeologists can. I'm an engineer. So, but I can tell you what they've. And it's unbelievable the amount of detail that is being taken from these monuments.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Righto.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Ralph. Bye bye. Well, Jim, this has just been fascinating, and I can tell you that when the time flies by like that, it's because we have an interesting and very, very fascinating guest, and I want to thank you so much. We just have a few more minutes here, and we do have Renee, who has been on hold. She's, and I'm going to, Renee, we're going to get to you in just a few minutes, so hang in there, girl. Lavendar, do you have any any last questions for Jim?
No, I just want to thank him for being on the show, and so maybe we should end with him and let Renee come on.
Okay. Now, Jim, would you please tell everyone again your website and where your book can be found?
Right. The book, Lost Secrets of My Technology, can be found on Amazon.com or on BarnesandNoble.com. And or you could tune into theoldexplorer.com, which is my website, because my birthday's tomorrow. So
your birthday's tomorrow?
Yes. So I'll be 75. So I made it this far, and I've got plans to go down and explore some more ruins in October, because I'll be busy speaking up till then. I got some good gigs too.
Well, this is really something, because you know. Your solar return is probably happening now or today, at least because of leap year. We're really honored that you're spending this time with us. And I do encourage everyone. I saw you do also have a blog.
Yes, it's on the same site.
It's on the same. It's on theoldexplorer.com.
Yes, one word, theoldexplorer.com. And for anybody who wants to see what the book's about, the site has almost all the elements of the book, with pictures and nice descriptions of my technology and their story.
Well, this has just been fascinating, and we want to thank you so much on behalf of the education of our listeners to learn about this. And we had no idea of the advanced levels of technology, but now we do.
Wait a minute. Must tell you, y'all have asked the best questions. They're really intelligent and, going right to the point. That's because you know so much about NASA and astronomy and geophysics and everything else.
We've really appreciated having you on our program.
You know, it's all tied in. And I would love it, Jim, if you would come back and visit with us again, because I think we probably still have a lot of things that you could talk about. So would you come back at some other show?
I'd love to.
Oh, mm-hmm. Excellent. So, everyone, we've been talking to James O'Conn, theoldexplorer.com, and do pick up his book, Lost Secrets of the Maya Technology. And thank you again so much for joining us, Jim.
Thank you for having me.
And we look forward to having you back. And next, we are going to talk to our friend Renee, so just give me a second here to get microphones switched around. Here we go. Hang on a second. Okay. All right. Renee, hello. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey. Thank you so much. My gosh, what a fascinating show.
Isn't it? Wow.
Oh,
we learned
my goodness.
A lot.
I didn't know half that stuff. It's just amazing, and I'm really fascinated with the Mayan culture, as we all are, especially in 2012.
Right.
So it was really, really great. And I want to thank you guys for having me back on again. I want to first just let everyone know, I'm doing the Tour de France again in September, and I wanted to let everyone know that we've just added on, in addition to, our precious Henry Lincoln, who's the real grandfather of the whole Rennes Le Chateau mystery, and including the Da Vinci Code, we've now added international best-selling author Tim Wallace Murphy, who's going to be also joining us, as well as psychic medium and Ayurvedic healer Dr. Lisa Hurt. So we've got a great program. And then, of course, Gloria Amendola, who's my partner in the tours, is an author and intuitive. And so we've got all these amazing people that are going to be with us, so I'm really happy to announce that. And if anyone is interested in going with us, we need to know right away, but we would love to hear from you. And my name is Renee Barnett. It's R-E-N-E-B-A-R-N-E-T-T. You can find me on Facebook. Or you can just shoot Ariel or Lavendar an email, and they'll be happy to send it on to me. But I'm also really excited because I do my own radio show, as you guys know, called Night Vision Radio on latalkradio.com. And tomorrow night, my very special guest is Lavendar. And so I'm so excited. I mean, I know it's going to be a really exciting show. She's going to be sharing some of her own experiences as well as information about the Teton meetings that are going on right now. And I think it's going to be some new ground for my listeners, and I hope that some of you guys will come on over and listen as well. And that's latalkradio.com, Channel 2. It's at 8 p.m. tomorrow night, Wednesday. And that's Pacific time. So it would be 10 o'clock Central and 11 o'clock Eastern. So if you guys will join us. And I really appreciate it. And I'm fascinated by your show today.
This was, we're just so honored. If everyone would just take a look at Jim O'Conn's website and see there's so much more that this man has done, we're just really honored to have someone of his stature on our show.
Well, it's really exciting that the engineers and the tradesmen are now getting into this kind of research, because they're the guys that really know how stuff works, and they're the guys that can figure out what technology was used and how things were built. And, you know, we love the archaeologists, but these guys are the ones that can kind of figure it out. So it's really exciting.
Right. Well, the archaeologists find the stuff, and then the engineers tell them what it was for. So
that's right.
But as far as Jim is concerned, I mean, he found this bridge, and everyone else had overlooked it. But with his eye of his history of being able to discern the cause for buildings that fell down or you know, structures that failed, that's his area of expertise.
Right.
So finding an ancient bridge that had long since collapsed was just right up his alley. And I would love everyone to just completely follow his work and pick up his book. And Renee, you're leaving for France when? In September the what?
In September the 16th, the tour begins for 1 week. And we're going to the Rennes Le Chateau area. We're going to be going to all the Cathar castles, some other kind of new locations where we're following up our own research, Gloria and I, and then Henry's going to take us to some exciting spots. So we're going to be all over the place down there, and I'm really excited to have these new additions to the tour, like Tim Wallace Murphy and Dr. Lisa Reed Hurt. It's really going to be exciting. I'm interested to have a psychic medium with us when we go. It'll be fun.
Well, yeah. And just in case it hadn't dawned on you, you are going to be there when the sun is at galactic degree in Virgo, which is all about service. So good
and
timing
we're being
there, girl.
At the equinox, and so we thought we picked this time especially because we thought it was a real powerful time. The energies in that region are really strong and very connected to what's going on up in the sky. So we picked our dates with that in mind. So we'll be doing some ceremony and things, you know, for those that want to participate. And for those that don't, we'll have plenty of other stuff going on as well.
Well, it sounds wonderful. And make sure that you contact Renee. You can go to her Facebook page. Or can they email you directly?
They can. My email address is Renee K. Barnett. And that's RENEKBARNETT @gmail.com. Or you can find me on Facebook and send a message, and I'll get right back with you right away.
Okay, and, yeah, it'll be quicker.
Please don't forget Lavendar tomorrow night, too, on Night Vision Radio. I'm really excited about that. I want to hear all about these Teton meetings. And then I know some of the things that Lavendar has done in the past over her amazing lifetime, and I want to hear some of those stories too. And our audience is just chomping at the bit waiting for her to come back, because this is her second appearance on the show. I think the
first time
she appeared was before you guys started on your radio show.
Right. Renee, you got the Giza crystals?
I sure do. And I'm taking those with me to France.
Well,
and
good.
Place them at some specific locations. But, Lavendar, as I told you, if you have any place in particular, because I know you know that area, let me know if you know some place I need to plant some, and I'll be happy to do that.
Well,
but
the thing about
I'm
the
Geese, I'm just going to choose some good spots.
Well, the thing about the Geese is they tell you where they want to go.
Well, and you and I have had that conversation before. I won't share all the details, but yes, they have found their way to some strange places.
Yes.
They do have a mind of their own, that's for sure.
And you just have to let them do whatever they want to do.
Yes. Yeah, that's what you told me the other day, which made me feel a little bit better about how silly I felt.
And, you know, I can't tell you where to place them because I just know that they're in charge.
Well, they are so amazing, and I don't know how many of your listeners have seen them, but they are the tiniest, clearest, sparkliest, littlest, tiniest crystals, and most of them are like double terminated, but they're like, you almost have to get a magnifying glass to really see what their shape is and everything. They are amazing. I've never seen anything like them.
Yes. And they are just really amazing healing properties. If things are going wrong with your body, sometimes just being around them, your body just recalibrates.
Yes. Absolutely. I think I know that one.
Yeah, I think you do too.
But anyhow, I'm so excited you're going to come on tomorrow night, Lavendar, and talk to my listeners, and I hope some of your listeners will come on over and maybe even join us in the chat room. I'm sitting live in the chat room during the show, and that's located at nightvisionproductions.com, and I do work in questions and comments from the chat room. We don't really have enough time to take calls. The show's only 1 hour.
Yeah, okay.
I want to make sure you have plenty of time to say what you want to tell us.
Okay.
Well, it's going to be a great show tomorrow night with
you
Renee Barnett.
You guys are so sweet. Thank you so much.
You're so
welcome.
Yeah,
we're going to have Courtney Brown on next Tuesday, and you had him on already, didn't you, Renee?
I sure did. He is a fascinating guy doing some of the most amazing work in remote viewing. You know, he is the academic in the field. He's the only one. He's the only scholar that's actually talking about remote viewing, and he's the CEO of Farsight Institute, which is a huge organization, and he works with all those remote viewers that were trained by our military, and using those same military protocols and some enhancements, they have trained more viewers, and he said the viewers now are more incredible than the viewers that actually were training them. And the remote viewing seems to be evolving, you know, and people are getting more able to do it. It is a training, and it does take a while. But some of the people that have been training now for a while are just absolutely incredible.
Well, they're floating because of their Starseed activations, I'm sure.
Well, I guess so, and I guess that's the time, you know, that we're in, is everybody's blinking on, so.
And I think he's from Georgia, too. I think he lives somewhere around Atlanta.
Yes, he does.
He's actually a professor at Emory University as well.
Yeah,
although
right.
He does his remote viewing stuff from at Farsight Institute, but he also teaches, I believe he's a math professor at Emory.
I think you're correct.
Ariel, are you watching the clock there? We're just about
out of time here. I have just enough time to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. And also thanks again to James O'Conn for joining us. Renee, we know you're going to have a fabulous adventure in France. And tomorrow night, Lavendar is on LA Talk Radio or Night Vision. They can tune in also on Night Vision Productions. So we're going to sign off now, and on behalf of all of our staff here at Starseed Radio Academy, Lavendar, Anastasia, Chris, Rose, we're saying good night. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Good night,
bye-bye.
Everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.